Before we begin today's show, I have some important news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June the 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $94,000 by that date. The great news is generous friends of the ministry have offered a new $5,000 matching grant, which will double your gift today up to that amount. That's why I wanted to take just a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show.
I am very excited to be joined today by Dr. Crystal Hurd, an educator, poet and researcher from Virginia. She's contributed a chapter on Flora Lewis, C.S. Lewis's mum, in the book Women and C.S. Lewis. And she's written her own book, The Leadership of C.S. Lewis, 10 Traits to Encourage Change and Growth. We're going to be talking about Crystal's work on various aspects of C.S. Lewis's life, as well as sharing a paper that was presented on her behalf at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, which was held at George Fox University. The title of Crystal's paper there was How Paternal Literary Habits Influenced C.S. Lewis. Crystal, we've talked quite a lot about Albert's professional career, but do you ever get the impression that he would have liked a career in literature?
Absolutely. Yes. He talks, he actually was an aspiring poet as a young man, like his son was, and, you know, couldn't get published. And this is why I think when Lewis publishes, I mean, Dimer, you know, was actually well received, just didn't sell much. But Spirits in Bondage, right? Albert writes that. We have that letter in volume one. But he says, you know, I can tell there's, you know, he has some reluctance with religion. He could see that coming through, even though, you know, C.S. Lewis hadn't really told him a whole lot about his own sort of atheism bent. But I think Albert read that collection and enjoyed some of the poems, but told Warney in a letter, like, I think he's sort of fallen away from his beliefs, you know. And I think that made him sad in a way. You know, but actually he tells, like, C.S. Lewis had another name planned for that book. And Albert says, you can't name it that. There's already a book out with that title.
Wow.
So, like, Albert already knew all that. And so they changed it to Spirits in Bondage. Yeah. Spirits in Prison, I think, or something like that. And then Albert said, no, there's already a book out like that. Because Albert was very well read and knew, you know, all the big books of the day and was familiar with that. It was always a hobby for him. And he did, as a young man, want to do that. But unfortunately, because he couldn't go to the school, get the education, get the advantage he needed because of his, you know, upbringing being working class, he couldn't do it. So he made absolutely certain that his sons had every opportunity to do that. But yeah, he said, we have a piece from the family papers where Albert was contemplating retiring at 53, I think, and said that he wanted to go into letters, like write for fun. But he never did, right? You know, he just kept working and kept working and kept working because his sons were bleeding him dry.
Yeah. Well, I guess in some way he got to live vicariously through his sons, didn't he? Through
totally.
Their literary careers.
Absolutely. I mean, he was super proud. Super proud. And yeah, I mean, back when he was at Oxford, they talk about even the postman in Belfast saying, oh, I'm so proud of Jack. I'm so proud of him, you know, because he had written on optimism and he won that prize. I mean, Albert was just beaming. He was so proud of him. Yeah, so you're absolutely right. He didn't get it himself, but he enabled his son to have those opportunities.
And Crystal, you mentioned that Albert was clearly disappointed when he realized that Lewis's faith was waning. I mean, what impact did Richard, and then obviously more significantly, I'd imagine, Albert's faith have on C.S. Lewis?
I think it created a climate of faith, and I really do. And like the family, like I said, went to St. Mark's pretty much basically as soon as they were married. You know, they went to the Hamilton Church, you know, and Thomas preached there. It's interesting because Thomas was supposedly would cry in sermons, which was funny. And they're like, oh, he's doing a weepy one today.
Yeah.
You know, he kind of grew up as a church kid, right? He was a preacher's grandkid, not a preacher's kid, but a preacher's grandkid. So he was kind of, I feel like he was steeped in all that from a very young age, like so many people. And Richard himself didn't really write anything beyond the reading room papers, but I'm certain he talked about it. And they obviously had Bibles, right? And Flora made sure they had their own right before she passed. Albert, I have to say, was the more I read about him, the more I come to understand that his faith was so pivotal to him and how he lived his life. Like I said, he could have easily made a left turn, become a politician, had tons of money, tons of fame, all this, you know, been very well known in the city for compromising on some of his stuff, but playing the game in politics. And when he saw how corrupt it was, he just couldn't do it.
Mm.
So I think his faith dictated to him his occupation. It dictated to him how he read, how he lived, how he handled business, how he handled his clients. It was like that sort of canopy that covered everything.
Mm. And you say in your paper that it wasn't until Albert's death that C.S. Lewis would experience a spiritual awakening, one that would lead to some of the most meaningful religious writing of the 20th century. So do you think that actually Lewis's father's death perhaps contributed to Lewis's conversion because it got him thinking about these big questions?
Absolutely. I mean, there's this great letter where he talks about going in to one of the stores there to put, so Albert, when Albert passed away, right, Lewis was, and this is pretty famously known, right, that Lewis did care for him for a while. And, you know, Albert was, you know, if he thought he was irritable when he was well, you know, he was very irritated at him. And being a caretaker is a hard job. It's a very hard job. Imagine being in your 20s, doing all this great stuff, finally coming to some of your aspirations, and then you have to stop and go home and take care of your father, who's kind of annoying anyway. Albert did accelerate his drinking later on in his life. I mean, there's the joke about the bit of whiskey. I think the older he got, the more he kind of leaned into that a little bit, which we kind of see with Warren at points. That was something I think he struggled with as he got closer to his own death. But, you know, even Lewis jokes, oh, the bathroom talk has went to 100%, right? He says in one of the letters, like, all he talks about is his problems in the bathroom, right? And it's so funny, you know, how he talks about, oh, my dad's always repeating the same stories and this and that, you know? And so I feel like, you know, famously, even though he sort of took care of him there towards the end. And he has that there's that letter that he writes to Owen Barfield, I think, right? That is Owen Barfield, where he says, you know, I'm at the sick bed of a man I can't make myself love, et cetera, et cetera. And then he says later on, and for the rest of the letters, he says, you know, I feel abominably bad about how I treated my father. Mm. He says, I'm being kind to just old men I see in the street as some kind of penance for how I treated my father. So yeah, I think he owed him more than he wanted to give him credit for. Mm. But he does talk about at that moment when Albert dies and the family collects at Little Lee. Unfortunately, he's there by himself. Warney's off, you know, serving in the military. So, you know, C.S. Lewis has to handle all this by himself.
Mm.
This is new territory for him, right? I think he kind of shut himself off after he watched, you know, all this stuff die with his mother, and his father just kind of just, you know, move on. But Lewis talks about how his uncles show up in one of the letters, and they all say, well, what do we do about a casket, huh? What do we do about the service? What's the tradition? What's the tradition, right? Because the Victorians were very big on, like, what's the tradition? And Lewis says, for the first time, I saw my father as a product of, like, his environment and his times, instead of that guy that really gets on my nerves, right? And he started seeing how his uncles were reacting to things, and he says, oh my gosh, you know, my dad was just a part of this larger thing. And fortunately, he realized it too late, but he does talk about going in to put some clothes on the charge account, like the underwear, right? That Warney's underwear. And he realizes when he goes in to buy the clothes for, like, the funeral and stuff, that he can't. There is no Albert. There is no account anymore. And I think that's the first time when it really hits him that this is everything's going to be different from here on out. Everything.
Yeah.
Everything at this point is changed, irrevocably changed. And even something as simple as, like, not being able to charge your shirt and pants to something. I think that showed him that, you know, this is something very different. Mm. And it's never going to be the same. And maybe you were a little severe. Yeah. You know. But Albert was a good guy, but I think he realized too late that he was just, you know, he was from a different generation.
Yeah.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
I just wanted to quickly remind you that Premier Insight has been offered a new $5,000 matching grant that will double your gift today up to that amount. And right now, that's an incredible blessing, as there is a final funding gap of $94,000 that must be closed before the end of our financial year on June the 30th. This show depends fully on the generosity of friends like you. So I'm asking you to please give your very best gift right now to close this gap, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. Thank you.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. And I suppose on that note, do you think we see any of the characters in Lewis's writings or any sort of subtle weavings within his works of fiction or perhaps his nonfiction that maybe reflect or contrast with his own experiences of his father and that perhaps reflect some of Lewis's views on fatherhood?
Sure. Yeah. I've mentioned Till We Have Faces. And I do believe that Till We Have Faces has a lot of Albert in it because, I mean, when we open that book, right, when we open that book, it says, this is my complaint against the gods. This is my, you know, this is my complaint. You're the plaintiff making your case against the gods. And then as we continue into part two, we actually have the courtroom scene and the judge and this very different take on justice. And like, and then I think that's when Oriole herself sees that she's kind of been a little unfair with her assessment of the gods. So, and like I said, God in the Dock is a great sort of using of those concepts of law applied to spirituality, right? Sometimes we put God on trial, right? How, you know, instead of, oh, how dare God do that, right? The omnipotent God. Instead of asking ourselves, what did we miss? How do we, you know, it's our fault. You know, that's such an interesting essay. And then when I started doing research on the family, it added a whole nother layer to that essay. Understanding how his father was for years, you know, trying to give people a fair shake in a system that just seemed, even it was established, almost prejudicial against these poor people who already had a hard shake at life.
Mm-hmm. Crystal, you've already mentioned that there was perhaps a moment when Lewis recognized that Albert, his father, was maybe like a product of his environment. And do you think that, considering the era that they lived in, did Albert influence C.S. Lewis's view on things like masculinity and gender? And was it significant that he was effectively raised by a single dad?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's important to note, too, that, you know, when C.S. Lewis lost Joy, he was a single dad with two boys.
Mm.
And I think that's like the first time he could have said in his life, now I understand. Mm. Now I understand. Right? Because you read A Grief Observed and you just see how deep that hurt goes. And even he says, even in A Grief Observed, when he was a boy, he hated when his dad would bring up his mother. Like it was a weird emotional territory that nobody wanted to traverse into.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wanted to talk about it. And again, I think that's sort of a Victorian sort of way of dealing, like males sort of dealing with it. Let's just scoot it off, pucker up. It's going to be fine. It's not a big deal. You'll make it. Be a tough, right? You can do this. Be tough. I feel like that was a big sort of idea with the Victorians. Like they were on the cusp of all this stuff and redefining, you know, society and culture and economics. And there were so many things happening. And like I said, I really feel like Albert is like almost like a character in a Dickens novel, right? Because he was like Dickens. He grew up poor and worked his way up, right? Into a good life, you know? So it's so interesting to me, like in the story of the half sovereign, right? The way he writes is very Dickensian, honestly. And then another story actually kind of borrows the first line from David Copperfield and kind of, you know, and so his short story is kind of a twist on one of Charles Dickens' stories. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like, I will say this, Warney was more like Albert and C.S. Lewis was more like Flora. I feel Warney Warney was more interested in games and camaraderie and, you know, all that stuff. He was more outgoing like Albert was. And even when Warney writes home and says, you know, I'm thinking about doing engineering. And Albert responds, well, great. That's great because your whole, you know, my whole side of the family has done shipbuilding for years and years. And so I applaud you. Keep going. You know, and some of the letters that we have to Warney during the war is just great. Just what a great encouragement that he gives his son. You know, please stay on. I know there's a lot of temptations like drinking, foreshadowing, but but he says, but stay the course, you know, stay close to your faith, stay, you know, be a man of duty and responsibility and be the, you know, he's always just offering all this great advice. So although C.S. Lewis was a little bit of a different animal when he was young, he was sort of, you know, he was babied, I think, a little by Flora. That kind of came out later. We have letters from Warren and Albert where they refer to C.S. Lewis as it, because he's so whiny, you know, and so fragile, you know. So I think in a way they kind of looked at C.S. Lewis as like not the, is a boy, is sort of the weaker. You know, I think C.S. Lewis felt it, right? Because he talks about in Surprised by Joy, I couldn't play those games. I couldn't do all that stuff that males are supposed to be doing out there playing the games and all that stuff. And so he felt that was a weakness in him, that he wasn't able to do all these things that Warney did, which is interesting because when we talk about the school situation with both of those boys, you know, Warney did not have as bad of an experience in the schools. I'm not saying, I mean, under Capron, it was all bad because that guy was crazy. But Warney, because he was more gregarious and had all, you know, he had a lot more friends. He was able to like come into new situations and acclimate. And C.S. Lewis was not. Mm. He was like, I'm going to the library. Peace out. I don't want to be around people. I don't know how to make small talk. I don't know how to do all that stuff. So he was very different. The two were very different when they were young men, you know, and young boys. But I feel like C.S. Lewis still was pushing him. I mean, again, that Victorian ideal of work is important and work is your contribution to society, right? So when you go back and read those letters when C.S. Lewis was trying to get a place at Oxford, he's writing and he's saying, I'm applying for all these jobs, I'm getting passed by, you know, and Albert's like, look, I'll pay for you to go ahead and do another first. You know, I want you to have these opportunities. I want you, you know, to have as much time as you can. I'm going to try my best to support you for the next, you know, X terms. Mm. And he didn't have to do that. You know, and we also know now, right, that he was not just taking care of C.S. Lewis. He was taking care of Maureen and Mrs. Moore also. Mm. And he knew he was doing that. We do have proof of that. He knew about it. C.S. Lewis was like, oh, no, I'm good. But he actually, you know, Albert knew that there was something going on with there. But he never like brought it up. He supported his son, even when there was some sketchy things happening, you know, behind the scenes. So I think that Albert tried to put those sort of Victorian ideas, you know, in his head. But like as a modern, he was very different, you know, as somebody in the modern generation, the World War II, you know, the World War I generation. They saw things very differently. Even Charles Williams, right, said that Charles Williams wrote somewhere, when my friend says that it's brilliant, when my dad says it, it's malarkey, basically. they just didn't respect their dads. Their dad was old school Victorian, that old idea, bleh, you know. But I think Albert tried to make him that contributing member of society because of those values he had learned.
Yeah. Crystal, we're about to hear your paper from the Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference on the literary influences of Albert and Richard Lewis. And in it, you mention Jack and Warnie's imaginative world, Boxen. Just before we hear the paper, would you briefly summarize Boxen for us?
Sure. Boxen is a collection of stories that mainly C.S. Lewis, but some contributions from Warren as little boys, wrote about animal land. And it features a protagonist named Lord Big. He's a frog, which Lewis said in a letter bears a striking resemblance to Winston Churchill. But he's basically like a bullfrog, right? And to be a children's story, there's a lot of politics and societal things in there, which I think are Albert's indirect influence, talking about politics, local politics all the time. But yeah, it's a bunch of animals and they, you know, they go abroad and they talk to each other and they have all these Victorian issues, you know, and yeah. So Lord Big is the frog, the main frog in there. And it just follows his adventures in his life and of people he meets, other animals he meets. So really interesting. They're not super captivating. If you're looking for Narnia, you won't find it.
Get to know.
You know, he was like 7, 8 when he wrote this stuff. I mean, you know, but I mean, how many writers can you find, you know, something that they wrote that young, right? That we can read now. So, you know, don't judge too harshly. It's not, you know, it's not Narnia, okay? It's not Narnia. But it's actually pretty impressive for a boy his age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the program. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com.
What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @PremierUnbelievableFE, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @PremierUnbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.